This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. For a few years, a large parcel of land off of George Street on the north side of La Crosse has sat vacant, waiting for someone or something to move onto the site that formerly housed Train Plant 6. Now, two local developers want to build a residential and commercial complex on the land with hopes of re-energizing the area economically. Here today to talk about the project is Jim Hill, the executive director of LADCO, the La Crosse Area Development Corporation, and Paul Borsheim. He's the president and co-owner of Borton Construction. Jim, I want to start with you. I'm wondering if you can maybe give us a brief history of this land and the former train site. What exactly went on there and what happened to it?
First, I'll just point out that the organization that owns this property is called the La Crosse Industrial Park Corporation, also known as LIPCO. That is a partnership between the City of La Crosse, XL Energy, and LADCO, my organization, that was created back in 1992 when real estate, putting forward some sort of real estate solution, was the thing that would unlock a desirable economic development outcome. That was its purpose. And so LIPCO has carefully selected different projects along the way.
Can you give some examples of other projects that LIPCO has worked on?
We've bought and sold property up at the airport when that industrial park was getting going. We bought the property over on Copeland from Super Value when those properties were being disposed, and held it until S&S Cycle was able to enter the market. We've done projects along the way. We built what's called the Second and King building in downtown La Crosse. Several businesses are located there. So anyway, in the middle 90s, just such an occasion occurred. Here we had Train Company, who owned that plant. It was called Train Plant 6, and wanting to dispose of it. It didn't need it anymore. And next door, another large manufacturer, La Crosse Footwear, wanting to use that property. It was a big 212,000-square-foot building. For its distribution, they were still manufacturing at that time, and yet they could not conclude a deal because of the extant environmental taint under the building. So enter LIPCO. Train indemnified LIPCO forever on any environmental liability, and we created a 10-year lease situation with Cross Footwear, and ended up using it for almost 13 years. Well, then Footwear did decide to go to a different place, a larger facility in Indianapolis. Now came the question back in the middle 2000s of what to do now. This is an environmentally affected property. Maybe it's time to tackle the clearing of the environmental offending substances. That would be Train's responsibility. That meant taking down the big building because the problems were under it. You couldn't get at the stuff. That happened in 2009. Train worked in 2010 and 11, taking away the substances, and then the property all along was being marketed, and now today has a would-be buyer.
And there are still some pollutants at the site, is that correct?
No, well, none that anyone knows of, per se. No, one of the substances was oil, and you go to any industrial site in the La Crosse area, basically, especially in along where the rivers have a higher water table, and there'll be some of that in the water table. The other was a substance called PCE, which was used in industrial cleaning tools back in the day after World War II. The oils were extracted over time, and the TCE was removed because about 10 feet of soil was dug out and taken away. So monitoring has had to occur over time, but there isn't any other known contaminants. What is still existing on that property is on the front of the property, underneath the area that used to have cars parked on it when Plant 6 was still in operation. Anyway, up there in the front, there's some rubble that would have come from the demolition of a building or something way back when, literally back in the 40s or 50s. some rubble and this sort of stuff underneath there, but it wasn't deemed hazardous by the DNR before, and it's the question we have in front of us is whether to just plain dig it out and take it away.
So at this point in time, anyone who lives in La Crosse, who's traveled through La Crosse, sees this land, and since we have a lack of free land in La Crosse, can see that an area like this does have potential. Paul Borsheim, maybe this is where you enter the conversation. Borton Construction and 360 Real Estate Solutions has proposed a plan pay $1.9 million to purchase this land. Can you talk about why it was that you all became interested in, and thought that you had the best solution for the area?
It kind of goes back a few years. Marvin Wanders, my partner with 360 Real Estate Solutions, and I were both involved in the Three Rivers Plaza project. And one of the things that when we develop a site, we try to look for mixed uses. And I think that that makes us unique from that standpoint, where a lot of people, when they look at a site, well, what's the one use that will work here? And we try to look at more of a 30,000-foot view of that site. And anytime you start talking about 10, 12 acres, you know, it really needs to be purpose in my mind for multiple uses. And when the RFP came out, Marvin and I got together and started talking about, you know, what do we think the right uses were. We had some discussions with Jim Hill, with the city, also with the neighbors in the area. We talked to the Fenagor Group, which operates the old rubber mills, you know, really tried to determine what those needs were in the community, in that area of town. Being a Northsider myself, I've always been very interested in redevelopment of the Northside and just looking for those type of opportunities. And the more we got into those discussions, you know, the affordable housing became very apparent as a need in a good location. Leo Bronson had been looking at this site for many years.
The chiropractor.
And he's expanded his business beyond just chiropractic care these days. Leo's been looking at this site and talking with Libco for many years. He really likes the concept that we've put together. We've been talking with grocery stores. We have multiple grocery stores interested in the site. We also think there's a small retail component. But then I think the bigger piece really is a small business park. As Marv and I discussed, we've seen a lot of businesses leave La Crosse once they started growing, moving up to Onalaska, Holman, West Salem, because there's really not the space available for them to grow their business. And maybe they're somewhere on the borderline of industrial, warehousing, retail, office. And as we discuss this concept, you know, we're looking for that kind of transitional area from the front half of the building towards the back half where you've got Reinhardt Foods and the old rubber mills to kind of make that transition, but still a very strategic location in town for vendors to have customers come to, but also for those vendors, if they have truck routes involved, to get around through the major arteries in La Crosse and out to outlying communities.
You're titling this the Red Cloud Enterprise Center, and as you said, Bronston Chiropractic is interested in space. There might be two retail spaces and about 60 housing spaces as well. Jim, when Borton Construction and 360 Real Estate Solutions came forward with this plan, why did this stick out compared to some of the other proposals that came forward?
Well, we issued a request for proposals, as Paul referred to it, an RFP, back in June. Five different parties responded. Only a couple of them actually were a whole site response, meaning they would use the whole site. Well, that immediately elevated our interest. We've thought all along that's, you know, more desirable to have a plan go into go through the process and into effect for the whole site, both from the seller's perspective, but it gives a larger footprint to accomplish things from the developer's perspective. So that was one distinguishing feature right away. Borton 360 has a track record in this market, a very positive one. That always is a very strong attribute. And then the vision that they were putting forward resonated both, you know, again, LIPCO is a partnership with the city and XL, those parties who have, you know, witnessed and seen a lot of different developments. they were impressed with this mixed-use concept. Just about everybody who has looked at this property has seen the potential for an affordable housing play, sometimes called a WIDA tax credit play. That's where the tax credits come from at the state level. That has, you know, been a component, frankly, from day one. Leo Bronson has a professional clinic in mind. That's been a constant. And then these fellas, Paul and his partner Marvin, added a couple of other elements, but especially that small business park element that all just really started to make good sense. So, you know, you add those three things together and you've got a very strong proposal.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guests today are Jim Hill. He's the executive director of LADCO, the La Crosse Area Development Corporation, and Paul Borsheim. He's the president and co-owner of Borton Construction. We're talking about a new residential and commercial development proposed for the north side of La Crosse. Paul, I want to really hone in on the commercial element to this proposal. Bronston Chiropractic will be, they'll be moving in for sure.
As we move forward with the developer's agreement with the city, we also need to finalize leases, but Leo's very in favor of the project, and we've been working with him to work out a lease.
Any business that moves in will be renting from 360?
Not necessarily. We're always flexible in how we set it up. We've had discussions with Leo that it may be a condo-type situation. It may be a situation where he's just strictly a tenant. It may be a situation where Leo invests in the entire project. So when we deal with commercial tenants, we kind of give them those options, what works best for them. We want it as a win-win situation for everyone, so we don't kind of put them in one-size-fits-all type of agreement.
And you mentioned the grocery store element that some people have come forward saying they're interested. It is kind of interesting because I looked at some maps and calculated this, but that area itself is actually considered a food desert. There's the Our Town grocery store is a little more than a mile away from that area. Festival Foods is a little more than a mile from the south of that area. So, I mean, is that one of the reasons that you would want a grocery store element to this?
Absolutely. You know, as we looked at this, a lot of people remember that Quillen's, it used to be Quillen's Food House, used to be part of the Menards Plaza on Lang Drive, which was literally two blocks from this site. And a lot of customers would from that community, that neighborhood, would walk to that site. I mean, it was probably one of your higher grocery stores for percentage of people that would walk to that site. And as we looked at it, not only is it kind of a food desert, I like that term that you came up with there, you know, the demographics, I think, are such that for that area, you know, we're probably looking at more like a discount type center. You know, it's not going to be a full service like a Festival of Foods. It's 50 to 70,000 square foot. We're thinking it's more in that 15 to 25,000 and a little bit less limited selection, but, you know, lower overhead so that the costs are more competitive.
Does that leave one or two commercial spaces left after that?
You know, it really depends upon what comes forward as far as people that are interested in that site, because we have the opportunity to put housing above the commercial. So the more commercial and density that we get, we'll be looking at that as we continue the design of the space. So, I mean, it's kind of in flux until you get a critical mass to move forward. You know, once we're able to sign 3-4 of the anchors, which is really your commercial piece, that's going to help set that tone as we move forward in those steps.
Jim Hill, I want to ask you, are there certain types of businesses that maybe you'd like to see move into that area, or is it important to have a business that would be a draw for that area?
Well, in a mixed use, you have a little of both. Paul's already pointed to a couple that would be a draw. Anytime you have a grocery, even if it's a discount, that's a draw. People who are in need of medical services, you know, for chiropractic or MD-type services, which is Leo's business model, that's a, you know, that brings people. If there's, you know, housing or living arrangements, clearly every day and in the evening people are returning home and then venturing off again the next day. So there's already that element going. The piece that was different and is added to this thought that Falls, referred to as a small business park, is a niche that is important for the area, so that if companies that have, say, an office and a brick facade for their office use, but then do have some need for a higher ceiling to do something behind their office space, they're wanting to expand and yet stay in this area, then they have a choice. Right now, there aren't a great deal of choices. So that's the element that sets this apart and is going to be very interesting.
And the residential component, Paul, why was it important to include this and not just have commercial space exclusively in that area?
You know, I think part of it is just the massing of the space. When you have the rubber mills right behind the site, and it's such an imposing building, there's over 300,000 square foot there, multiple stories. You know, I think part of it, if we had just looked at a single-story facility, I think it would have been challenging to make it look appropriate in there. The other thing is there is such a lack of space in La Crosse that you need to, when you do a development like this, you want to look for density and how to better utilize your land, your parking, those type of things. So I think that was the two factors that really drove us that way.
It's one of the first steps in building up in La Crosse.
Correct. And, you know, it's funny you say that because as I was driving down La Crosse Street to come here today, there's new apartments on the north side of the road. You see a parking ramp going in. If you look at La Crosse over the last 5-10 years, you see a lot of infill type projects, a lot of renovation where La Crosse is going up at this point. And you know, it's not only good for the tax base; it's also better utilization of your land.
So these residential spaces, will they be apartments, condos, or is there going to be a variety? I'm wondering if you can just talk about the different opportunities and sizes that will be available.
Sure. These will be workforce type apartments. One of the components is we've been dealing with Common Bond. They're the company that would own them and rent them out. They've been involved in veterans-type projects, so we're looking at having a component where about 20% of the apartments would be for veterans only. You know, there's obviously a lot of veterans coming back to the States right now. There's a lot of needs that aren't being met. We think it would be a great location for that. And I think just the other day I heard a report where La Crosse was one of the top three, or the third one for size town for hiring veterans. So I think there's been a lot of support in our community for veterans. With Fort McCoy, the veterans that we have in the area, I think it's just one more opportunity to help serve the people that have served us.
So would it be maybe just for a single person, or is there going to be spaces for families to move into?
Yeah, it's really for both. You know, there will be some market level apartments. You usually do a mix. Based on the incomes, based on the jobs, but it'll be both for singles and for families.
And why apartments? Why not homes? Why not build single-family homes in the area?
Again, it kind of gets back to, I think, expectations and density. If you're going to build single-family homes there, I don't think for the cost of the land, I don't think you could justify the size of the homes that would go there and what the cost of land would be. I think you're competing right now. It's my understanding there's like an 8-year supply of residential lots on the market in our area. So all of a sudden to add even more lots to the market actually drives the price down. And, you know, this is more commercial type land. The added bonus of having the housing there is kind of that cherry on the sundae, so to speak.
So let's talk about Common Bond Communities. This is the St. Paul group that you'll be working with on the housing element. Why is it that you chose to work with them, and what can they do and what can they bring to this project?
They're one of the largest affordable housing companies in the country, and they have over 5,000 units. And Marv and I were both impressed. They've been looking at our market for a while, trying to get into it. We've been talking to them for over a year before this RFP even came up, and we've just been so impressed with both Amanda Novak and Chris Laurent from this group that you know, we felt very comfortable when this RFP came up that, you know, they were already kind of part of our team. And, you know, we talked through it, the process, what they would bring to it, and it was really just a comfort level.
So do they help maybe suggest the best way to set it up, or will they be managing the homes once this is developed?
Actually, they do both. They've been Chris has been involved as we've laid out the space and, you know, what amenities they're going to be looking for, how to do the parking, you know, the scale of the project. They've been involved in those type of decisions. And then they will do the management. They'll own the housing, and they'll manage that for us.
So sometimes when you hear affordable housing, it doesn't always necessarily translate to quality housing. Is there going to be a balance between the two?
Yeah, and I think that's really the key. And I think if going back to Jim's comment about, you know, Marv's and my credibility on something like this is we've always built long-term. We don't take a project, build it, turn around, and flip it, per se, in a year or two. You know, we're the type of developers where we like to hold on to it long term. We're both in our early to mid-40s, you know, but you do need to find that balance. Obviously, the financials have to work at the end of the day, but if you have an opportunity to use a better product, let's say cement board siding versus vinyl siding, we always err on the side of a better product, less maintenance, something that's going to hold up over time.
Jim, do you want to comment at all on the affordable housing side of this project?
Well, I just, in effect, sort of take a nod from those who are in that business. Every affordable housing company in the upper Midwest, but several happen to be located in Wisconsin, we're the first ones to see that opportunity, that not only in from a market perspective, but where the site is located and the high traffic area. So, you know, that tells you something when people whose business it is to understand these things and put forward projects are the ones who are first to respond. That goes back even 3 years ago when this plan was all starting to take shape. So that, you know, I trust those folks as to know what they're doing, and all of us know this market too. You know, we intuitively it all made sense. So that, and it's something the city has had in its long-range plan. It fits the thinking that those that are looking out for the city's long-range interests. Also, the Northside Business Association and the Lower Northside Neighborhood Association, two groups that have cared deeply for their area and for the community, they have understood that was going to be an element and have very positively endorsed that idea, too.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about a new residential and commercial development proposed for the north side of La Crosse. My guests are Jim Hill, he's the executive director of LADCO, the La Crosse Area Development Corporation, and Paul Borsheim, he's the president and co-owner of Borton Construction. So it seems like the initial costs, and these can always change over time, but the initial cost is about $15 to $18 million to build this. Will it be Borton Construction and 360 Real Estate Solutions that will be financing this project?
Right. Marv and I will be working with, we'll be the general partners. A lot of times on projects like this, we will have some limited partners, and then we'll go to financial institutions to get the financing. Usually you end up needing to put down 20 to 25% for a project like this, and, you know, it's another step in the process, but a step that's well underway.
And there are some talks of potentially developing a tax incremental financing district or a TIF. Can you talk about that and why exactly that would be needed?
Well, I think it really goes back. It's my understanding, and Jim can confirm this, that the TIF is already set up for this area, and part of it's because there's infrastructure that needs to be upgraded.
Roads and whatnot.
There's roads, there's streetscaping, there's utilities that need to be moved, there's fill to be brought in. This is a site that is in the floodplain that'll need to be raised 4 to 5 foot. There's still some of that rubble in the front that needs to be removed, so we basically made a full price offer for the land. to make the financials work on a project like this, you need that assistance from the city so that a project like this can go forward.
So, Jim, is that how it would work? Would the city pay for some of the utility and site upgrades? And is that how the TIF plays into this?
Yeah, the council adopted or passed a resolution authorizing the creation of a TIF a year ago in September. The final action on it isn't slated until May or possibly June. But the thought all along has been that even though TIF can become controversial, at least sometimes, what generally is not thought to be out of the realm of why a TIF is formed is infrastructure, things that prepare a site for development. Paul touched on it. If you put all of that site preparation and the finishing of site preparation on the back of the developer, what price expectation you have at that point melts away basically to nothing, because how can they shoulder both a full price and infrastructure? So it really becomes a choice. And TIF was created back in the 70s with bipartisan support in the legislature for the very purpose of infrastructure. This would be an infrastructure TIF, hopefully modest in scope, and that's in the spirit of the city's newly adopted policy on TIF. Use it sparingly, stay mostly to the whole needs of infrastructure, and have a quicker payback, and then monitor all the cost inputs along the way. That's the new way, and we had that fully in mind, and that's what we'll be journeying through the council at some point.
So just beyond the infrastructure improvements, that's all that the TIF will deal with?
Well, that's all that you know, that LIPCO, as one part of this, is asking. This is, after all, America. You know, somebody, if they so see fit, can make other requests. But that is all that we're putting forward, and it's, at least for most of us, I think, a generally understood agreement that that's what this will be characterized as an infrastructure TIF.
So when we look in the future, and if this project is built and people are living in the apartments and coming and going from the different businesses that will be put there, what sort of difference will this project make for the north side of La Crosse or even the city as a whole? Paul?
Well, I think it really continues the revitalization both of the north side and of the city of La Crosse. I think our project 6 years ago with Three Rivers Plaza really started that process on the north side, and you see the new elementary school going up that'll be open next year, you know, with Plant 6 being redeveloped. That's another step in the process. And then, you know, there has been some movement with the mobile site in the city moving ahead with the charrette process next year. I believe it's in May.
And Jim, from a LADCO standpoint, what sort of difference will this make for the entire city?
It shows that the city and its partners through LIPCO, and then partners that come from the development arena, can work together and accomplish something special. This will be special. It already is as far as a proposal, but it will be special and appreciated for years to come. That's always a strong message, tackling something that needs to be done and then later everybody being able to be proud of it. That whole aspect of neighborhood preservation and enhancement can't be lost in this discussion or any of these that have to do with new development. It's been a priority of this of the city or its leaders in the last number of years, and now it's starting to express itself in many different ways.
Jim Hill is the executive director of LADCO, the La Crosse Area Development Corporation, and Paul Borsheim is the president and co-owner of Borton Construction. Today, we were talking about a new residential and commercial development proposed for the north side of La Crosse. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, television journalist Soledad O'Brien visited the area last week as part of UW-La Crosse's Distinguished Lecture Series. Hear her talk about the importance of reporting on race and culture, as well as the state of 24-hour cable news. Archives of this and other recent editions of Newsmakers and photos can be found on our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. Newsmakers is also on Facebook, like us at WPR Newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Soledad O'Brien is one of the most celebrated journalists out there, who's made it her goal to tell people's stories. After working at NBC and spending about a decade with CNN, she's covered everything from Hurricane Katrina to presidential elections. Beyond the hard-breaking news of the day, O'Brien also anchored the documentary Latino in America and the series Black in America. Earlier this year, O'Brien left her post at CNN to start her own production company and is a special correspondent with Al Jazeera America and Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel. Soledad O'Brien was chosen as this year's speaker for UW-La Crosse's Distinguished Lecture Series. Soledad, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I want to first talk to you about your reporting on race, culture, and ethnicity.
Sure.
I think it's a topic that seems to be, I think more and more outlets are really understanding the importance of it. But can you just first talk about maybe the moment or moments that sort of inspired you to really dive into race in a journalistic way?
We started covering Black in America in really before the 2008 election. I had been asked if I would work on a documentary that took a look at the assassination of Dr. King, and we were assigned sort of six-hour block to look at the assassination and then kind of the state of Black America 40 years after the assassination of Dr. King. At that point, when we were assigned, a guy named Barack Obama had not yet decided, in fact, that he would run for the presidency. We probably were about 18 months before, you know, in the conversations 18 months before. And as we started working on this doc, of course, race and skin color and identity and all these sort of issues about black and white in America kind of came to the fore as he decided that he would run for the presidency. And as I think there were some very, you know, sometimes rough conversations, I think very blunt conversations about race and class and opportunity and poverty and all these things that, you know, I had been covering probably a piece of them. I mean, Hurricane Katrina was not a story about race, but of course it was in a way, right? I mean, it was a story about a hurricane and a levee that failed. But really, there was a great piece of that story that was about race and class and having the opportunity to leave and having the cultural sense of a place of home that you wouldn't want to leave. So for a long time, I'd been covering race in a lot of ways. But I think when I started doing Black in America, it became very clear, like, oh, there's so many stories that we could tell that really are just flying under the radar, that no one's telling them. I mean, there's a zillion stories. So our first Black in America was really successful, and that led to the second. We're shooting the seventh right now. And in each one, we've changed the format a little bit. We used to tell a series of stories, and now we really spend an hour telling one story, which I think in any kind of storytelling is better. It's just a better narrative to not jump around or cut away to another story.
The personal impact.
Absolutely. Over an arc over a full hour has been, I think, a really great way to tell those stories. And they've been wildly successful. And then we did Gay in America, the story of Gary and Tony having a baby, and Latino in America, several documentaries on that front. We took a look at Muslims in America with our documentary Unwelcome, The Muslims Next Door. And we did a documentary on women who were rescue workers post 9/11. And it was really interesting because every single time it starts this conversation about race and gender and class and whose voice gets to be the voice. And I just find those conversations really incredibly interesting.
Beyond the stories themselves being interesting, it's been really nice to see this shift within national media. You have your Black in America series. NPR's created their Code Switch team. Of course, there are blogs, countless blogs out there that are really exploring race. But is there more that can be done, I don't know, on the national level, but even statewide
sure.
media or local media? Are people doing enough to really talk about race?
I think there's just a lot of stories. I mean, I wouldn't even say that there's some compunction, like you have to tell stories. You know, I think it's just there are great stories. And if you're a journalist, right, the job is to go find a great story and come running into your head and say, oh, my God, I have a great story. I'm going to need a lot more time for this story. We've all done that. And I think that the thing that's amazing is that there are these communities, Native American population, Asian population, where there are great stories. And they're not the cliched one or two stories that we all know. There's a bunch of amazing stories if you would just take the time to dig in, or if you would take the time to talk to people or hire people who are of those communities who are willing to give you insight into those stories. It's just about any time you want to do a story, right? You can't just run in and run out. You have to sit down with people. And often, I don't know if this has happened to you a lot, but it's certainly happened to me. I go in thinking I'm covering one story, right? And then by the time I'm done talking, I'm like, oh no, the story we're really doing is this story. Yeah. You know, because storytelling takes time, and you've got to draw people out, and you've got to get to know them and sit in their lives for a good minute. So, I think there's just a lot of great stories to be told, and we do everybody a disservice when we sort of fall back to the cliches that every Latino story is about immigration and every African-American story is about crime or entertainment and every Asian story is about, you know, higher education. There's so much more than that.
So why is it important to explore beyond the stereotypes? Why do we need to talk more about race?
Your audience is more diverse than ever. You will not appeal to the people who are listening or the people who are watching. The demographics of the nation are changing very dramatically. And so I think it's a business imperative. You run the risk of not appealing to your audience at the same time when technology has enabled people to find the stories that they want anywhere. I mean, back in the day, you couldn't find any radio station you wanted to. You know, you listen to this when you were here. You listen to that when you were there. You watch shows. I know you all are way too young for this, but some of us in this room are well aware that there was a time when you ran to the television set and you watched a show when it was on. There was no time shifting. There was no sense of like, I'll just watch the entire series. You know how I watch shows now? I watch the entire series on a plane.
You're a binge viewer.
Yeah, I'm a complete binge viewer. I find it very efficient. Boom, got it. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. I couldn't tell you when any of these shows are on. So things have changed very dramatically. So that audience, if you're not serving them, they'll just go somewhere else and they will be served. I mean, they'll just go find the content that they want. It just won't be with you.
But it's also, in a way, changing the narrative and the way that people are thinking about race, too. So it's beyond just appeasing to those listeners or those viewers.
Well, I think that there are lots of conversations already happening about race. And I don't think that the only people talking about race are black people. I think actually they're, you know, clearly what the election of a black president showed us was that everybody's talking about race. That white people were very interested in talking about colorism when we did our documentary on colorism. That I had many people, many Indian Americans who'd say, well, colorism happens in our community, too. So I think that again, it's, you know, you don't just do stories about race because you're hoping to appeal to minorities. You do stories about race because those are the conversations that are happening in the world around you. And the job of the media is to reflect and dig into those conversations and understand them. If your idea is to just sort of show this quilt of America, you know, and you're leaving out all these conversations, or the face of the discussion is not particularly diverse, then you have a quilt with a lot of big holes in it. You know, it's not really held together very well.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien. She's this year's speaker for UW-La Crosse's Distinguished Lecture Series. Our next question comes from Kristen Barbarisi from WXOW.
Thank you so much for being here and for having us on Newsmakers. I guess I want to talk to you about, we've seen kind of an evolution of partisan cable news. How do you think that's impacting journalism and the credibility of journalists?
Well, how it impacts journalism, I think, is technically, theoretically, right, shouldn't vary much. At the end of the day, journalism, good journalism, has a very defined set of rules. And so there are either people who are doing journalism well or they're doing it poorly, but it's not that they're, you know, changing the definition of journalism somehow. You know, you could be a great journalist with fantastic equipment and, you know, absolutely top tier, you know, materials, or you can be a journalist who's just got a pen and a pad, and you can still be a great journalist. And so I don't think things like social media really change the tenets of good journalism, right? Those kind of stay the same. They can influence the speed at which we get stories and the opportunities we have to track down stories, things like that. I think what you're seeing is how has it changed TV news? My challenge with the way a lot of interviews are done today is that it's sort of set up like two screaming congresspeople, you know, and if you were landing from Mars, you know, you'd think that everything centers around Washington, D.C., that everybody's really, really bad there, you know, and they can't get along and they're quite unpleasant to each other. And that some networks only cover that kind of horse race every day. And it's sort of unfortunate because I think that the reality is in this country, it's really not about the horse race, right? That the policy has implications that are outside, you know, the Washington, D.C. And so you could tell great stories about people who are experiencing those very things that those angry congressmen are talking about. And you could get much more information and a lot more nuance and a lot greater understanding across the country about what's happening with certain policy decisions rather than someone saying, well, Senator, you're ugly. Well, Senator, he said you're ugly. How do you answer that? Well, I think he's ugly, too. Well, Senator X, he has said you're ugly, too. How do you respond to that? And you end it with, well, gentlemen, listen, we're out of time. I want to thank you both for joining us. Like, you know, I mean, that really is the 4-minute version of how that craziness goes. And no one learns anything. It's what we call good TV, right? It's great, dramatic, over the top. Oh, my God. They were crazy. He was yelling at him. He stormed off. He ripped his mic off. But did anybody actually learn anything about policy that's affecting them? No. So why don't you actually do stories about human beings through whom we can see the effects of policy? I think that would be much more illuminating.
And our next question comes from Brad Williams with Wisdom Radio.
And along the same lines, since you are well associated with cable news, is there less respect for the media from where you are in the industry than there was a few years ago? Because being in this market, I will read the paper and listen to talk shows, and it's like, oh, the media, oh, they're all liars. You can't trust them. They're all on one side or the other. And there are people who feel if you're going to be a reporter, you should be Julian Assange and be the outsider and exposing everything. Is the media from your position fundamentally different than it was 5-10 years ago?
I don't think it is, actually, although I think that the polls would show that like trust and like of the media probably has gone down a number of points, and you know, you guys could all reference that and check that. But I'm fairly confident. But you know, when we would cover big breaking news stories, you know, people would come and thank us. I remember walking through Baton Rouge Airport after Katrina coverage. We were there for about 2 weeks, living on the floor of an RV on Canal Street. And it was, you know, you're wearing the same clothes. It was disgusting. I remember at the last minute, I threw into my bag. I just had kids. I just had babies. So I had 4 kids, but I had babies. And so I threw into my bag a thing of baby wipes. I was like, oh, I might need these. Right. And I was doling them out like, here, Anderson, would you like a baby wipe? Because that was all we had. You were in mud and muck all day and you couldn't take a shower. There were just these baby wipes that I happened to bring from home. And at the end, so we were walking through the airport and we were disgusting, like literally completely disgusting. I had my CNN baseball cap on. And people gave us a standing ovation. People gave us this, you know, and it was such a remarkable thing because it felt like we were doing the job of journalists, right? That's what people wanted journalists to do. Get out there and tell stories and be brave and find people and tell their stories and make sure people understand what's happening and hold people accountable. So I think the public goes back and forth. There are things and moments where they feel like, wow, this is done the right way. And there are certain institutions that they think do really well. And then there are others that they think, you know, do less well. And I think it's very easy to lose the public trust. And I think it's hard to gain the public trust. I think it's, you know, Al Jazeera, which is starting a new network. One thing I've been really impressed with is that the types of stories they do are just, you know, things that I want to watch. And if they keep doing that, right, they will build an audience slowly but surely. They will be able to grow an audience. They have said, we're going to do interesting stories that not everybody's doing that are kind of off the beaten path while covering the important stories of the day. So far, that's what they've done. You know, but it's easy to lose people's trust if you start, you know, delving into stories that are silly or you give away people's trust. Yeah, you'll lose that audience. I think it's very easy to lose it.
Our next question comes from Pat Anderson with the La Crosse Tribune.
You feel like you have more creative freedom now that you're with Starfish as opposed to being with CNN and some of the other stuff you've done.
Which is your
Starfish
your
is my new production company. You know, I never felt very stifled in terms of creative freedom. There are certainly stories that I was pitching and sometimes people wouldn't buy the pitch, right? So it's not exactly creative freedom. They just weren't interested. So when it came to doing Black in America, I felt like I had a lot of creative freedom. I could do it in pretty much any way I wanted to. I never really like bumped heads with people about, you know, I see this vision and you see this, you know, the other vision. What I have really enjoyed about running a production company is we have started doing work on movies. We are pitching the kinds of docs that I wanted to do that others, you know, didn't really weren't interested in the pitch. Well, you can go to a bunch of different places now and say, you know, I'm interested in doing this doc and researching it, and you can get people who are interested in backing it. So I think what it does is it gives you an opportunity to find like-minded people who are interested in the projects you're interested in. It allows you to completely get rid of people you don't want in your sphere. You know, truly, one of the greatest joys of working for yourself is when you're with someone who you do not want to work with. You're like, and that is that. Goodbye. You know, I literally never have to see you again. Unlike your actual office job where you sort of are like, oh God, I'll see you again tomorrow. And we're working on a project. So that's, you know, and what that does is it makes you work on projects only with people who all want to be on that project with each other, right? Because everybody could leave if they wanted to. And that is actually really, really fun. People are excited about building a company, and that's kind of the people you want in your sphere. There's nothing that we at this moment have said, you know, we won't do. So as long as it's interesting and it's something we want to do, we'll tackle it. And that's kind of the fun of building a business in an environment where media is changing so dramatically, you know, and where so many people are looking for content. I mean, you know, the number of people who are interested in our content don't necessarily have to be networks or cable channels, or, you know, it's incredible. That's been a big shift.
Are there topics that in having your own company that you will be able to cover now or very much looking forward to covering now?
Absolutely.
For more than an hour or two, I would assume.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting? For sure. You know, I always felt that when we did our Black in America docs, we would air them and you'd get this giant viewership. And then it was like, goodbye, black people. We'll see you again next year when we do our next Black in America. You know, I mean, it was still, but there was this great conversation. We did a documentary on colorism, and people were going crazy on Twitter. We're having all these great conversations and debate. And then literally it was like, okay, bye. How do you take that audience that wants to be engaged in conversation? And they don't only have to watch your stuff, right? Those are the same people who are, you know, reading other people's blogs and are just interested. How do you stop and frisk, right? So how do you have an interesting conversation about stop and frisk that can continue over time? I think that there's an ability to do that. And I was never able to do that when I was at CNN, right? It was like, okay, I'm on to the next thing. I'm doing a morning show. I can't keep this audience engaged around this topic while I'm also going to work on this other thing.
So can you talk about integrating a documentary film or a TV special along with social media and, you know, any other plans that you have
sure.
That can surround a project?
I mean, we did it all the time on CNN. You know, when we would air a documentary, invariably it would trend, you know, on Twitter. And that was because I'm an absolutely passionate and frantic tweeter. And so I would, you know, I'm very aggressive and I answer people back meanly if they're mean to me. You know, but you're engaging in some kind of spirited debate. I think that's a great way to keep that conversation going. We started a YouTube channel and people can subscribe. We'll launch officially in February with a Black in America channel where we will have, you know, new content all the time and allow people to curate their own content as well and do Google Hangouts. And that'll be part of our YouTube channel in addition to the documentaries that we continue to do. So we have all these great sort of multi-platform. Some of those things will be, I'll be producing them or I'll be in them. And some I won't be in them at all. You know, it's not, I'm not the face and the voice of Black in America. I'm a journalist and we want to hear everybody's story.
You mentioned stop and frisk. Is there anything else you're looking forward to potentially tackling?
You know, I think poverty in America is a huge story. I think nothing has really been done very well of late on Native Americans. That is not the classic, oh, the bad statistics, you know. I know that there are amazing and hopeful stories there, but no one's really done them. I think that there's just a lot of great stories about neighborhoods and communities. So those are the kinds of stories that we're going to do. And, of course, you know, poverty in America is an amazing story to dig into. And unfortunately, you know, new statistics were like, what, 1 in 6 Americans are poor. That's I just find that shocking. Like, I'm stunned that that's not. You know, that's not what people are talking about. They'll have two congressmen yelling at each other over, you know, the website. Is it working? Is it not working? Who should be fired? 1 in 6 Americans is in poverty. That's a terrible thing.
Soledad O'Brien is an award-winning TV journalist. She visited La Crosse as part of UW La Crosse's Distinguished Lecture Series. As a matter of disclosure, I am a member of the committee that selected her to speak at this year's event. Thanks to WXOW's Kristen Barbarisi, WISM's Brad Williams, and La Crosse Tribune's Pat Anderson for being a part of our media panel. And thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Stroob, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find extended interviews and photos. And if you'd like to comment on our program or have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also find Newsmakers on Facebook, updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.